Yeah, good morning. I know for some people we do a lot of it seems like a lot of ritual compared to some American Dharma centers. Actually, for Asian Dharma, whether it's Theravada or Zen or Vajrayana, we're actually pretty low church for people that have actually been to traditional centers. But we have a beautiful environment and do the rituals so that it supports our pure vision or our imaginal world. Also, it's our continuity of tradition. I've made a very bold vision to do Dharma practice that's workable for people that didn't grow up Dharma, and at the same time be true to Indian Vajrayana roots. That hasn't always been an easy balancing, my teacher, and particularly from old times, and particularly Jhadar Rinpoche and Basang Geshla, get really upset when I am not traditional. So when I'm not wearing robes and doing traditional Dharma, because that's what they're used to. It's just seen as a sign of respect and being helpful. But actually, naturally, I tend to be kind of casual. I'm considered like a high lama actually in the tradition, so I have to have a certain decorum like that, so I've gradually become more accepting. Okay, that's this is helpful. That this is I'm willing to do that, so that particularly I'm paying playing it and paying it forward, so to speak, like that. I'm very suspicious of American imperialism that thinks like, well, we'll just toss everything, thinking that our culture, like we know it all, I'm watching a series, I think it's just called Buddha on Netflix, that Susan Farrar told us about. It's kind of a Bollywood world. A little bit. It's kind of nice, actually. I've just gone through three. I think it's just called, it's on Netflix. It's 45 minute series. I recommend it too in the sense that it's also probably also a way that contemporary India sees the Buddhist tradition also as embedded within their tradition, you see, where we tend to think like it's just portable, right? We tend to think, well, we'll just take the cultural piece out of it and then that's the pure Dharma. I don't think that's so easy, I don't think it's so easy to just we don't want our culture removed, right? If everyone stopped doing so everyone stopped hugging in California, if we said, well, you can't do that anymore because that's a cultural phenomena and we want to do pure Dharma. We get really upset, we're huggers in California, like that. So I respect California too, The other day, He says, "Oh, can I give the Lama a hug?" And I said, "Sure, you know, of course." So, but they wouldn't play in Asia. Don't. Even if you ask permission, don't. But yeah, we don't want to stop hugging, right? We don't want to stop doing that. So, why not? Okay, let's do prayers. This morning I'm going to give a rambling talk about Shambhala. A rambling talk, yeah. So, when we're giving a scholarly talk about the view, and when we're talking about meditation techniques, then of course we want to be very you know, precise and somewhat like a, you know, presentation with a definite beginning, middle, and end where you can follow it. So that it's more like a university talk, something like that, or you're getting the concepts correctly and the tools correctly, so forth. But when we're talking about journey, we're talking about path, it has to be rambling. I see many people every day, either in Dharma or psychotherapy style. It's actually not all that much different, but because no one wants to give a case presentation style of their life. Okay? Case presentation style in a hospital setting, which I know how to do, would be a 45-year-old Caucasian woman complaining of GI, da-da-da-da, and her blood pressure is this, and she's been to this group or that group, and da-da-da, and interventions or these medications, and she's been assigned to a DBT group, and or this and that, and this is Kaiser, and that's it. No one... I'm a Kaiser member, I can say that. So, you know, no one wants their lives like that. Everyone's, I'm not a diagnosis, I'm a person, and here's my story, right? No one presents themselves. Somebody did present themselves like that, like, "Hi, I'm a, you know, you know, 63-year-old, blah, blah," you know, that would be kind of strange, right? So when you're talking about path, actually how we're living Dharma, if the talk is presented that way, you'll get a really wrong impression about how to, you know, actually have Dharma life. You'll actually have like, how do I bring, you'll have questions, which I know we ask, but they really don't make sense. And the question is, how do I bring Dharma into daily life? Well, daily life is Dharma, so, but it does help to have some information, and that's when you give formal teachings and formal meditation practices. But talking in general about what we're going through is the path, so it's kind of rambling, right? Everybody I talk to has a rambling, right? They go, "Well, now I'm rambling." People say to me during the day, "Well, I'm sorry, I'm rambling now." And I finally go, "Good. Now we're getting somewhere." Because, you know, then people are starting to go in the flow, and people's Dharma presentation or their life presentation isn't so rehearsed, right? I also like it when people kind of forget what they were talking about. Yeah. Yeah. So Even if we have a little dementia, okay, you know, big deal. But means maybe the thought has run out. So let's if you can't remember what you're saying, then just pause there. Okay? We had a Mahamudra retreat a couple of weekends ago, and I spoke about stopping, like putting on the brake, but also there's rolling to a stop. I want you all to be able to meditate enough so you can't remember what your narrative was. Just let it roll to a stop. The narrative starts changing too when we're actually appreciating rambling a little bit. That's when our strong sense of this is my story and I'm right, this is my story and I'm sticking to it, begins to wobble a little bit like a top, you know. I'm old enough I can remember tops, you know, you'd spin them or something, and they run out of energy and they kind of... So in advanced practice, you know, we say let it just kind of roll down, right? In advanced practice, of course, we've already set a foundation where when the top, so to speak, falls, it falls on soft ground, right? That's important. That's why we're doing all these, you know, foundation practices, the rituals, the visualizations, developing bodhicitta, developing kindness to ourselves and others, developing some insight into mindfulness, what's happening in the now, so that when our, you know, hardened story, which we normally just call our ego or our self, falls apart, it doesn't fall apart in a bad way. So it just kind of dissolves apart like that. Sometimes, you know, it's said in 12-step, you know, somebody has to hit bottom or reach their bottom first. We have to do that in Dharma too, but I don't ever want it to be like a hard fall. Yeah, people reach their bottom all the time. Guess what? They kill themselves, okay? That's not the bottom we want to reach. So when things are starting to fall apart, we want to do it in a creative kind of rambling way, and then there's this feeling of real relaxation that happens. It's different than slamming on the brakes. And it's so much different than landing on hard concrete. Don't you agree? Yeah, so we're doing all these practices so that we can, you know, kind of fall apart or disassemble ourselves or be, you know, post-structuralists, and it happens in a gentle, spacious way. Yeah, I don't want people to, you know, land on the hard ground. That's not helpful ever. So that's why sometimes when we're talking about really profound journeys, it has kind of a rambling quality to it. Or maybe I just can't give a coherent talk. I don't know. So I was really happy to host Kangsar Rinpoche here. A couple of weeks ago, wasn't that marvelous? he's in his early 40s, so you know, looks young. very well educated. you know, eighth in his line of incarnation. And so it's interesting, like, wow, like number eight. So it was confirming for me. Because he's very easy to talk to, and he had a tour, and he said, "Oh, wow, you're doing Tai Chi here, you know." He said, "That's really fantastic. There's, you know, there's a lot of complementarity between Tai Chi and doing Tantra," and this felt confirming to me because sometimes people think, "Well, why are we doing Tai Chi and martial arts here? It has nothing to do." You know, so course, you know, I just liked hearing that, you know, because I'm doing Tai Chi myself. So, it's kind of nice when, like, Ma San's there, and then having a senior moment, but an FPMT Geshe was there from Colombia. Maybe someone knows Geshe's name from Colombia. We end up speaking a little Spanish instead of Tibetan. My Spanish is better than my Tibetan. And so it was nice for Kangshirim to say, oh, this is really good. I want to learn Tai Chi when I come. So I'll set up a lesson for him next time he comes. Then second very confirming thing is he goes, oh, this is great. You know, I'm really glad you're doing, you know, psychotherapy kinds of things. So then he said, do you Skype? Actually, I haven't for a long time. I said, well, yeah, but then he goes, what's your Skype password? Can't remember. Okay. But we're going to do kind of a tutorial. He wants to, you know, have a tutorial on psychology. So that's also confirming because many teachers have said, oh, this is good. This is a Western style. It can be a Western style of doing Dharma too, you know. I've always gotten a lot of encouragement from that, so that felt good. But sometimes when visiting teachers are there, they're very conservative, you know. And so it was nice. You know, he's very innovative. So we'll have him back, you know, of course. Today I'm going to read briefly from a text I've been writing called The Shambhala Journey. And it starts out kind of differently. You don't have a copy, but eventually we will. So journeys start out, you know, like with a dream. They don't start out just with the foot on the ground. So, like Buddha's journey actually started with his mom's dream. Mahamaya dreamed of the white elephant. So, coming to her. The neat thing about like movies now or TV now, you know, the special effects are pretty good. So, like in the Buddha thing out of India, you know, this white elephant comes, right, like that. And it's dreamy, and then it gets start forming imaginatively in something I like to call reverie. So this is a really important stage in meditation. When you get up in the morning, this is for people who want to practical advice for today. I must have some practical advice, some people say. So don't immediately jump out of bed and slam coffee down, you know, and then, you know, so you want to really wake up very slowly, kind of dreamy. You know, yogi style actually is you just kind of lie there, capture if you can, or allow the dream to still be present, and then gradually mix it with, you know, the cat's on my head, or something, and gradual, and then yogi style is if you're not disturbing anybody, then you know just you know sit up in bed, okay, just. You may not be sitting in a hard bed like they have at Sarah J. But you can prop yourself up with some pillows, you know, maybe against the headboard, and just kind of like gradually wake up, right? You want to start off kind of sleepy meditation. actually. You're not doing any prayers, or you're not necessarily having to plan out, okay, now I got to do this, now I got to do that. Just gradual. And then later you can slam some caffeine or something and then do, you know, like more so-called formal practice, but you want to wake up kind of slowly. Dreamy, so doing some reverie like that. Does that make sense? Yeah. My old teacher was kind of a character for being, you know, you always expect monks to be, or geshes to be always kind of a little puritanical or something, but, you know, and then you always think, well, where did they get this information? But Geshe or John used to say, well, you know, don't jump out of bed after making love, and don't jump out of bed after waking up. That makes sense, right? Then I don't know where he got the first one, but maybe he heard about it. He said, your lover won't like that, you know. I'm all done, bye. You know? So don't run, you know, don't jump out. This should be really good news to people that wake up slowly, right? Yeah. Okay. Because the journey work is a process of dream and reverie, visioning, imagination, reparenting in a way, starting over as a child again, starting out in that kind of childlike world. This is how the Kala Chakra initiations go, right? We start out as child, right? And then also in the journey world, we've been through Hinayana and Mahayana practice. So we realized at this point, particularly after reading and studying Lotus Sutra, that's my pitch for my Monday class, we're on a shared journey. There's some examples actually in Western literature. A shared journey is like Canterbury Tales. Did you have to read that in high school English? They're doing this pilgrimage, and to make time go, they're telling stories to each other. A long drive in India is a good time to tell stories. It's much nicer than listening to music the whole time. Then also we have shared stories. There's another Italian Renaissance called the Decameron. Do you know what that's about? That's people are telling stories because they've escaped the plague in Florence. You ever been stuck with someone in some emergency situation, and for a long enough time, you know, you've kind of run out of, like, practical, how are we going to get out of this mess? And you end up kind of telling stories a little bit. And then other famous in the West is the Divina Commedia, the Divine Comedy, Dante. Dante's always like talking with Virgil or talking with Beatrice, you know, dialogue. Even Don Quixote is like dialogue. Do people like musicals? Man of La Mancha, you know, it's like, yeah, do you like me? Okay. You know, like the Sancho Panza and Don Quixote. Don Quixote read too many books and novels on chivalry and went crazy. But did he really go crazy, you know? That's kind of the irony. But people go crazy if they actually read too many Dharma books all at once. So don't do that, you know? You know, people come and say, oh, I'm reading Thich Nhat Hanh, I'm reading Dalai Lama, I'm reading Pema Chodron, I'm reading, you know, what you tell me, Lamla, and I'm, you know, I want you to read my books first. But so you're reading about 10 books at the same time, and you go a little Dharma crazy. People know what I'm talking about, right? And then you go, I don't know what to do now. Stop reading so much. Okay? Don't read more than you meditate. You know? Tenzin Choki, the wonderful nun who's now director at Vajrapani. Some people know her, very tall, right? You know, she says, oh, Lamala, that's, I'm going to use that one. This was years ago. Don't meditate. Don't read more than you meditate. That means some of you are going to have to do a lot of meditation, right? Ha ha, you know, read faster. Okay. So the Shambhala journey will take me a few Sundays to get through. I wanted to talk about journey and present, you know, somewhat of rambling talk, right? How am I doing? Is it rambling? It's a little? I don't know. Actually, lamas in India, Tibet, traditional ones do this a lot. You know, they'll be talking, even kind of formal talk, talking about emptiness or something, and then all of a sudden they'll go, just like Kangsha Rinpoche said, no, you know, this is kind of off topic, but it reminds me, and then they'll just kind of, very Indian too, by the way, you know, they'll just kind of go off and start talking about something. Kangsha means, Kang means house, and Sir means like yellow. It's Sir can mean, S-E-R can mean golden too in Tibetan. So I said, is that golden? And so, do you want to be golden house? And he goes, no, yellow. Fine. He's very humble, you know, like, okay, yellow's good. Okay. Yellow, you know, so it doesn't have to be golden. You know, it's like some teachers, I'm just telling this little story about him, you know. Some people go, it means golden mansion. You know what I'm saying? You know, he's just kind of, no, yellow house. You know, yellow house on the corner, three houses down, yellow house. He's very, very, very direct like that. Good. So I'm just going to read a little bit from this story like that. And this is like a guided meditation. So you're meant to... you know, pay attention, but in kind of a dreamy kind of dreamy way, like you're hearing kind of a story that you're a child and you're hearing someone's kind of telling you a bedtime story, so you're half asleep. Instead of kind of like, I got to figure this out and nail it, that style. No, this is not that style. That's someone's reading a kind of a, you know, fairy tale. And so the what called the Shambhala journey, a guided meditation, starts like this. You always begin a journey right where you are. You are here in Sacramento, a place you know well, and make your way through every day. You see cars, drive and hear the sound of traffic. You can see hundreds of trees, birds, and squirrels. You can feel the heat of summer. You go to work each day at a job you really like, and in your spare time you do the normal things. Run errands, go to the store, and such. On the weekends you enjoy time in your comfortable home with your family and friends, having meals or watching movies together. It's a very ordinary life, but you are happy in it, satisfied with your typical routine. It isn't exciting, but that's just fine with you. Things are going pretty well, and honestly, you really wouldn't want them to be different. Who would want to change this pleasant day-to-day world? I'll just kind of pause for a moment. Imagine that one day on the weekend, you're out window shopping, stopping at a small stores and boutiques. As you shop, you see a bookstore you've never noticed before, and on a whim, you go in. Inside, it is a little dusty and dim, and the shelves are packed with every type of book you can think of. Definitely an old-fashioned place. A book lover, you're amazed. You've never discovered it before. As you squeeze your way toward the back of the store, you accidentally knock over a small display of a new book by the Dalai Lama, The Golden Thread, The Path to Shambhala. But you catch most of them. Placing them back on the table, you realize that as much as you'd like to browse, you could probably use a cup of coffee. You begin to walk toward the coffee shop down the street. It's a cool but sunny day, and you're enjoying the walk. A few doors down from you, you notice a black bird perched on a bike rack. At first, you think it's a crow, but as you draw closer, you can see it is way too big to be a crow. It's a raven. You keep walking toward it, and it seems to be intensely staring at you as you come nearer. A little nervous to walk by, you hesitate, and just then the raven spreads its glossy black wings. Launching itself into the air, it flies just inches above your head, almost touching you. Then it flies off over the trees. It's a very odd encounter, but by the time you get to the coffee shop and order, you've pretty much forgotten about it. I'm going to give an auto commentary on my own text. Yeah, it's very kind of strange, but that's what Buddhists do. The important part is not that you exactly do this kind of duplicate in your own imagination this kind of journey. You know, I'm into bookshops and ravens and stuff, but. It is important that you start out with kind of ordinary reality. And then be open to something different happening. Something different does happen, actually. In the teachings from the Samadhi Sutra, we have the four wheels of the chariot. I've given teachings on this before. Chariots in India, I guess, had four wheels. And first one is mindfulness. We all know that one, right? Second wheel is relaxation. third wheel is friendliness. Fourth wheel is openness to, or even expectation that actually something will happen. So, in Vajrayana practice, we're open to something different happening outside the normal repetitive thing. But we create this present, warm, inviting situation to land in. So when the surprise happens, it's not necessarily traumatic. Trauma, samsara, is like we're overwhelmed, right? Usually it's because something bad happened. But actually, we don't recognize fundamental nature of our existence or of our mind because we're overwhelmed by surprise. The world, our experience is so incredibly alive and vivid, so incredibly open and free that actually we freak out. It's a little bit like Plato was talking about, like people leaving the cave and then it's so bright that you want to go back into the cave. It's exactly like that. So in our training, we have to train to develop the ability to be surprised, have something happen that is outside the normal karmic world, but not be overwhelmed. Because actually, from our Dzogchen Mahamudra perspective, highest teaching perspective, we aren't overwhelmed by the crappy things that happen. We're overwhelmed by our own awareness. It seems like a funny, but you know, we kind of like panic a little bit, and then we move on. So in this journey, we have to start out with this kind of ordinary, safe world, which for people who want a formal teaching for today, it would be like four wheels of the chariot start off with being gently present, relaxed, friendly, and open. Being kind of the fool, you know, in the tarot, the fool stepping over the edge. Kind of like a little dog, you know, just barking. Is the dog barking to warn us, or is the dog happy we're going over the edge? I don't know. So, but there's a little bit stepping into the future. You don't know exactly where you're going, but it's not going to be traumatic in a negative way. We're going to be open to that journey. Easy, right? It's easy. Okay. So we should take a short break and come back, have a few questions, and then you can do your own journey practice, right? Calling it meditation, you know? No one knows what you're doing when you're sitting there, right? Okay. Like I know we all want to be really good people, or we are, but I'll just tell you, you have to pick a cheat day every once in a while. So you're sitting there and you know, you're going, okay. But you're actually like kind of, you know, like thinking about something totally undharmic, right? No, I didn't say that, just kidding. Okay, well, okay, we'll reconvene. And oh, one quick announcement before we do the second round of announcements. Yeah, please. Just kind of overview for people. In our tradition, when we get together, actually, you know, we do prayers and discussion and actually guided meditations. Sometimes we call those sadhanas or pujas or something. Guided meditations like on a Buddha, like Buddha Bodhisattva like Chenrezig or Thar or Medicine Buddha or something. In American Dharma centers, lots of times they use the group practice for doing, you know, silent shamatha practice, you know, mindfulness practice where there's no you know, there's no visualization or narrative or something like that, right? In our tradition, we generally don't do that because the shamatha practice, shamatha vipassana practice, the formless practices, you know, are a little bit more solo, right? So the idea is you have always this mix of solo practice where you're creating a really generally very quiet environment, and then a group practice where you're on a shared journey together. So I don't know, I felt necessary to explain that a little bit, you know, because sometimes people think, well, another Dharma center, they said 45 minutes. Well, I want you to go home and sit 45 minutes. But, you know, also in our tradition, you know, sitting completely rock hard still is not super important. Maybe I'm just doing this practice because I injured both knees playing football in high school, and you know, if I can't move every once in a while, it's really excruciating. So, you know, that's why maybe I'm a Zen or Vipassana dropout, you know. But I can sit pretty still, actually. But, you know, when we're doing group things like this in our tradition, it's always chanting or singing together. It's always a group practice. That's what we're meant to do. So if you want to be really quiet, alone, and not bothered, then you get alone, see? That makes sense, right? So there's always this interaction between alone and then with others. That makes sense, right? Easy. So when we have a few minutes like this, you know, generally we're trying to do incorporate a talk or continue the guided meditation. But also, if you want to plan what you're doing afterwards, that could be part of your journey, right? That's okay. You know, just know it. Just, you know. We start out doing silent meditation, just 6 minutes. And you know, then maybe, you know, add another 6 or 12 or something. But it's actually in our tradition, it's better to like do 6 minutes, you know, during the day, you know, like 6 minutes 5 or 6 times a day. then you know, start out doing long sittings. This, you know, it's kind of continues the journey, so to speak, but also prevents, hopefully presents people resting in the famous psychiatrist Alexander Vaughan said, resting in your masochistic lair. So I've been doing this a long time now, and I realize a lot of times people, they do long meditations and they think they're, well, I'm sitting with my, you know, whatever. But actually you're wallowing in it and it doesn't do any good, you know, or you're just learning how to endure feeling like shit. And that's not Dharma, okay? You know, so we don't want to train to have a stronger masochistic, you know, like I'm just going to learn to endure the suffering and be, you know, heroic bodhisattva because of that. That's not, you know, how long would you keep, you know, if something got a little speck in your eye, it's windy sometimes in Sacramento, and something gets stuck in your eye, are you going to keep it in there for 45 minutes? No. So we it's not that we're pushing away, you know, nasty things, but we're not just holding on to them, thinking that, okay, if I sit with it for an hour, 45 minutes, or half an hour, then I have a better meditation. You don't. So start off, you know, with good motivation and awareness and gentleness, like the four wheels of the chariot, and space it out during the day. If you can maintain, you know, longer periods without kind of, you know, just sitting sitting in a dark hole, then do it. But there's no advantage to that in our tradition. We're not doing that kind of practice. Like, that makes sense? Yeah, yeah. So we're in the healing healing and liberation business. We're not into avoiding, but we're not into, like, I've just got to stay and be miserable either. So that the healing side, you know, is most important. That's why my teacher suggested, you know, having healing clinic and things like that. Happy to say, you know, we're at Middleway Health, we're having a person very skilled in Ayurvedic treatments joining the practice. So that's really neat, you know. And I'd like to have more, you know, seminars and things of that, and lines for traditional medicine folks from acupuncture and Chinese and Tibetan style Ayurvedic teachers. This is very traditional, you know, and Mense Kang, the Kang, as you know, means house. Mense, men means menla, healing. So the healing hospital university is very big in Dharamsala. It's always part of one's Dharma practice to learn how to be a healer and to take advantage of healing practices. There's absolutely no advantage to saying, well, I won't do any healing because I'm supposed to heal just with my mind. We're not doing that kind of practice. So all the lamas, all the teachers I know, they say, well, you know, dudes, you need to eat this, and do you take these pills, and do you do these herbs, right? There's no kind of thing where you're saying, oh, just meditate it away. No lamas do that, right? I have relatives who are Christian scientists, and I believe that things come out of spirit and mind, but medications and healing practices, all the teachers do that, you know? It's huge. Sarah J, they have little clinics all over the, scattered throughout the monastery. That's easy, right? Okay. Let's do prayers or, yeah. In virtuous actions, we may quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha, lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel Bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow. May that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. The land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenrezi Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Flourish, and may the upholder of the teachings remain forever. May all migrators achieve happiness, and may fulfill all their temporary and ultimate goals.
Please remain always unperishing, unchanging, unfading.
Akhteshvara, great treasure of objectless compassion, Anjushri, master of flawless wisdom, Anjupani, mother of entire Hosamaras, Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the snowy land sages, Losang Drakpa, I make request at your holy feet.
Yeah, thank you. I usually, when I have time, I, you know, exit and just sit in the library office, and people are, you know, welcome to visit and say hi. Usually other people are sitting around, so it's not like super private time. If you want that, then, you know, call me. But that's fine to do that, say hi. Or I like to say hi to people. It's good. Any more announcements? We're all set? We've said it all? Yeah?